Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and today we are talking about Hoffman's Ladder, and we have a returning author here joining us, and we're going to be talking about the research he did for his book and the release, which was called Hoffman's Ladder. We've got Richard T.K. Hell, Jr. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So, what made you decide to write and research about the Lindbergh baby?
Well, it actually started when I was 18 years old. My freshman English class in college, the professor asked us to do a research paper, and it had to be on something we'd never researched before. So I went to the library, and I found this small book, and it had a lot of brief stories about, you know, famous things. And it was the type of book that had articles like, "Did Jesse James Really Die as History Tells Us?" You know, "Are UFOs Real?" That type of thing.
Yeah.
And one of the ones I came across was an article, "Did Bruno Richard Hauptmann Kidnap and Kill the Lindbergh Baby?" And when I saw that article, I remembered a number of years before seeing an old TV show called In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy. And they had done a show on that. And I remembered a little bit. And I remember there was a man with a kind of a bad mustache who was insisting that there had been a travesty, that the person hadn't done it, and so forth. I found out later that person was Anthony Scuduto, who wrote a famous book about the case called Scapegoat in 1976. And so I decided that that would be my project, and I read Anthony Scuduto's book, although I didn't know that he was the guy, which was kind of amusing when I found out later. And I read one magazine article by a guy named Tom Zito, and based on that incredible research, I reached the conclusion that Hauptmann didn't do it, and I wrote this paper. And it came back, and I believe I got a B+. And thought to myself, geez, I thought I deserved an A. And looking back at it now, I think I deserved an F. But the research was terrible, and it was poorly written.
Yeah.
But thereafter, I would see books on the case, and I would pick it up and read it. And the next one I read was The Airman and the Carpenter by the late Sir Ludovic Kennedy. And he had the same conclusion, but for different reasons. So, okay, I read that. And then I read the Lindbergh case by Jim Fisher, which takes the position that Hauptmann was guilty. So now I'm thinking to myself, I don't know what's going on here. They're citing the same evidence. So I thought to myself, well, I know there's an archives in New Jersey. I'll go there. I'll look at the evidence. And in a couple of weeks, I'll know what really happened. 20 years later, after continuing research, I said to myself, you know, I've done all this research. Maybe I should write all this down so nobody else has to go through this crap that I had to go through. So I wrote the book. And at the time, it was more for myself. You know, whether I got it published or not didn't really matter to me. I just wanted to prove I could do it. And then February of 2012, my father passed away. And Dad and I were very close, and I wasn't handling it very well. And I needed something to throw myself into to deal with it. And my work as an attorney wasn't going to do it because that was something that I associated very closely with my father. He wasn't an attorney, but me becoming an attorney, I know, was so important to him, and it just kind of permeates my thoughts when I'm working. So I decided, well, I'll rewrite the book. And I did that. I figured it would take me a year. It took me a few weeks. Oh. And so then I said, all right, I'll get it published. And so, because I'd really, you know, I'd written the whole thing out, but I did the revision, and that only took a couple of weeks to revise it. So I did a second revision to make it better, and that didn't take long. So I decided to try to get it published, figuring that'll never happen. The next thing I know, June of 2012, I've got a contract to get it published, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Well, there we go. We're all done.
The sad thing, really, though, and it was my father's death that prompted me really to do the extra work needed to get it published. But then once I got it published, the one thing I wanted to do more than anything else in the world was bring it to him to show him, look what I did. You know, so it was kind of bittersweet in that regard.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's tough how it works out like that. So when you did it, I'm just noticing because it is pretty polarized. There's so many people that are very cynical, I would say. Just to police and law enforcement, I guess, overall. So the actual investigation was kind of done in a not very professional manner, I guess is the best way to say it.
The first night, yes, but thereafter it was good. It was the first night that was bad, the actual night of it itself, because they didn't cordon off the scene properly that evening, and reporters got on the scene to the point that a lot of the evidence, especially the footprint evidence, was compromised. They actually had to bring there was a ladder found at the scene, which was the most important evidence, thus the title Hauptmann's Ladder. But they actually had to take that evidence before they could process it, remove it from where it was located before it could even be photographed where it was, and bring it into the house because reporters were touching it and moving it and so forth. So they had not properly preserved the scene. And that became a real problem later on. But after that evening, they were much, much better, and they did a pretty thorough job with the exception of that first evening. But as they say, you can't unring a bell, and there's problems to this day with certain pieces of evidence because of the footprint problems and lack of photographs on the evening of the kidnapping.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of reading and research I've done on it, not to your extent, but it seems to be an underlying theme that Lindbergh himself might have done it, either from a practical joke, and there's all sorts of little, rumors out there. Mm-hmm. Why do you think people were so cynical toward Lindbergh himself?
They weren't originally. At the time, Lindbergh was the most popular man in the country, if not the world. After he became very much anti-entry into World War II, he began to get detractors. And, of course, as time has gone on, we've learned that he fathered a number of children out of wedlock, and he took positions that, by today's standards, would really be politically incorrect. He was involved in eugenics research, and he made comments which, by the standards of the 1930s, were not all that outrageous, but by today's standards would be considered extremely anti-Semitic. And he has falsely been accused of being pro-Nazi, which is not true. He was actually a spy for the United States against Germany. But so his own reputation is taken a beating. Where these things came about, accusing Lindbergh of being involved in the crime, they originally came from a book written by two men named Modir and Augur. And they made the claim that Lindbergh was committing a practical joke, because he was known for committing some cruel practical jokes. And they said, well, he was committing a practical joke, and the kid accidentally died, so he created this kidnapping, and he allowed Hauptmann to basically go to the chair knowing he didn't do it. The problem with that theory is they don't have a shred of proof, and he didn't have sufficient time that evening to do what he would have needed to have done to accomplish this. That's the first thing. The second one comes primarily from the second edition of a book by Professor Lloyd Gardner. In his original edition of his book, he doesn't talk about this, but in the paperback edition, he makes a contention that Lindbergh was involved, and his evidence is, well, Lindbergh was a bad guy. Well, there were some bad things about it. He was not a saint, but there's no evidence whatsoever that shows that he did it. And they say his motive was, well, he was into eugenics research. Well, that is true, but that doesn't prove he committed murder. They say, well, the baby was deformed. Well, the only proof that the baby had any deformity of any kind, he had a condition where his toes overlapped. That's without right. question. Mr. Gardner contends, based on some evidence that he has, in my opinion, twisted, other people don't agree, but he says the baby had rickets. That's not confirmed, but he asserts it. And his position is, well, Lindbergh was in eugenics, he wanted the perfect child, and he didn't want anybody to think his child was imperfect. That may be, even if that's true, that doesn't mean he arranged for the child to be murdered or anything else. It's a lot of speculation, and there's no evidence. But, you know, ever since the JonBenet Ramsey case, where all the everybody was accusing the child's parents of being involved in it, it's become the thing to do. As soon as a child is kidnapped or is killed, it must be the parents. I mean, that's the automatic conclusion many people jump to. Right. And it's unfortunate, and you see it in a lot of different cases like this. People go into cases with a preconceived notion, and when you have evidence that can be argued back and forth, isn't it interesting how they always twist it the way they need it to fit their theory?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm sort of finding it's the times, too, right? Because people are creating sure. their own evidence from feeling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
no
how
question.
They, you know, how they feel about something or someone like Lindbergh, so all of a sudden it's, well, you know, he probably did this or that. It's kind of like, well, just because you don't like him or you don't like his standards, or even if you thought he was a bad person, doesn't mean he killed his own baby, right? That's just kind of...
That's right.
It's kind of the common thread right now. I find a lot of people jump on that as soon as they don't like a character, then anything possibly that they could have done wrong, they did. You know, that was just... It's crazy. You know, but that... I was going to say Gardner, and he's also the one. He wasn't he a fingerprint expert or something? And he said that the prints were never on the ladder itself.
Now, Lloyd Gardner is a college professor. To my knowledge, he's not a fingerprint expert. The thing with the fingerprints, what they're talking about is this: on the night of the kidnapping, Investigator Kelly dusted for prints, and. There's two things where they talk about prints. One is he dusted the ladder, and he found some prints, but not a lot. He also dusted the nursery, and the urban legend is, well, the nursery was wiped clean because he didn't find anything. Well, that's not true. He found smudges and marks. Now, for those who don't understand basic fingerprinting, if you have a clean surface and you touch it, you don't slide your finger, you just touch it, you've in all likelihood have left a print. Okay. If you go back and you touch the same spot and you slide your finger around and you keep touching it over and over again, you may not get a clean print. You may just have a mark there, and that's called a mark or a smudge. If you wipe the surface clean, you're not going to find a mark, smudge, or print. You will find nothing. Kelly found marks and smudges, which means it hadn't been wiped clean. He just wasn't able to find a good print. Now, thereafter, another man, some days later, named Dr. Erastus Mead Hudson, used a different process where he would spray this chemical, and when it was exposed to the sun, it would turn a particular color, and you could see more prints. He found a lot of prints on the ladder. But the problem is, by the time he was allowed to do it, the ladder had been touched and moved by so many people that whatever he could find was, you know, wouldn't would have very little validity because so many people touched it, and you know, what was there before might have been smudged and so forth. So this idea that, well, Hauptmann didn't leave prints, if he did, they weren't found, and just because he may have handled the ladder doesn't mean he would have left a good print.
Yeah, yeah. And the other talk that people tend to do is that there's a kind of a blame for Betty Gao, who was the child's nurse, you know, or, you know, baby care or whatever you want to call her. She was kind of like the full-time aide for the child.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah, but there was no real, there's no evidence really to present that she really had anything to do with this.
No. What happened with Betty Gao was there were two different estates. There was the Sauerland Mountain estate where they were staying at that time that only recently been constructed. That's where the baby was kidnapped from. And then Lindbergh's in-laws lived at the Englewood estate, and they were over there quite often. Well, Betty Gao was there on that evening, and they asked her to come over that afternoon because the baby was just getting over having a cold, ironic since I'm battling one myself. And Mrs. Lindbergh was starting to come down with it, so they decided they were going to stay there for a while, which they hadn't really been staying there for the most part during the week, just during the weekends. And so Betty Gao came over. Well, she was supposed to go out that evening with a man named Red Johnson, so she called him basically to call off the date, and then was brought over by one of the other servants over to the estate. Well, when the defense was trying to poke holes in it, you know, and they were trying to make a claim, well, it was the Lindbergh servants who betrayed him. And they say, well, she spoke with this guy, Red Johnson, and that must be how it got out. Later, there was a maid named Violet Sharp, who wasn't even at the Sauerland estate, who got accused as well. And she was harassed so much, she eventually took her own life.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, but these are the types of things you'll see, you know, especially in a major media case where there's all kinds of, you know, accusations being made.
An interesting character, and I think you explain him quite well, was the doctor, Dr. John Condon.
Condon. Yeah, character is one way to describe him.
Well, I didn't know how else to say this, because he was quite, you know, it's a complex person. And
yes.
So many things that he did were strange, but then not really strange if you kind of understand the character. So I think you did that quite well, because you kind of covered a lot of what he was. And I think that could be a big problem with a lot of the people that actually talk about this case or write it, is they don't really capture the essence of this guy. You know, this guy is quite unique. And in the, I found, especially like in the police interviews and the interrogations, like when they had the lineup, and Hauptmann's in the lineup, and of course they retconned him in, and just the way he behaved in that whole episode, yeah. And also the way people perceived that whole interview. You know, it's kind of I think that's really key in this case.
Well, that interview, the part of the problem is there are three different versions of what happened. All right. We have Condon's version that he wrote in his book, Jaffe Tells All. For those who don't know, Jaffe was the nickname he went by in the case. He called the book Jaffe Tells All. And his version, when you read it, you know, you see there's underlying themes in it, but he makes himself out as such the wonderful hero. And, you know, he was tough but compassionate. And, you know, it was like, you know, you read it and it was like some kind of a comic book superhero the way he described himself. Then you've got the second version was the version that Bruno Richard Hauptmann, the defendant, had given to reporters. And his version is that Condon was screaming, no, I won't testify against this man. He didn't do it, which I don't buy either. The third version that doesn't get reported as much because it's not as outlandish as the other two is the report that I relied on. And in that report, what you see is Condon basically focused exclusively on Hauptmann. He was asking him tons of questions and having a conversation. He even spoke with him in German and said, Wahrheit ist besser, Richard, which means the truth is better. And obviously Richard used his name.
Yeah.
He tried that, and he tried, you know, he had another time he met with him, and he clearly what he was saying to him, he was trying to get him to confess. And so there's been so much speculation as, did he, you know, some people say, well, he didn't identify him because he didn't think he was the guy, and they was threatened and forced to do it, which I find doubtful because Condon, if you tried to force him or pressure him, he would have got his back up and started fighting back. Jim Fisher, who wrote, who I mentioned before, wrote a book in this case, has an interesting theory that could have some merit in that he says he had seen so many pictures and looked at so many different people that at this point it was a blur to him to even try to pick if it was the right guy. Well, that's possible. You know, other people are just, you know, some people theorize that he was getting senile. I mentioned that possibility in my book. I don't buy that. I mean, later there's some indications he was, you know, a few years after the case that he was declining because he was an old man. I mean, you know, he was in his 70s, which is not all that old today. In the 1930s, that was a different story. But in any instance, I've kind of come down with my idea more of it is that he knew it was the guy. He figured he could, you know, become the conquering hero and get him to say something. And when he realized he couldn't, he said, yeah, yeah, whatever, that's the guy. He wasn't going to miss his opportunity to testify at trial on, you know, front page news and all of that. I mean, but his whole thing was his ego, that he was all about self-aggrandizement. And when you look at the different statements he gives to the police, there are certain underlying things that always appear. But each time he tells it, he makes himself more of the conquering hero. He's like, I think every town, no matter how big or small, has a bar that you go into, and there's an older guy in the bar who likes to tell tall tales. And each time he tells a story, it's basically the same, but it gets a little more intense. And, you know, what he did was just that much more impressive type of thing. And after a while, you know, he doesn't even know what the real story even is anymore because he's told it so many times and enhanced it so many times. And I think that was a lot of what Condon was.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find that the opinion of people when they talk about the police is really kind of how they feel today. You know, they might have a negative opinion toward police. So all of a sudden they think in the worst terms. You know,
sure. And there are other people who will believe anything a police officer says. I mean, it goes both ways. You know, it's hard when you're doing these things to realize that whether they're police officers or whether they're teachers or lawyers, there are some that are honest to a fault and there are some who lie. And you can't paint them all with the same brush.
Right, right.
And it gets difficult. You got to take your time and really look through the evidence and then say, okay, where does the evidence lead me as opposed to, hey, I want to prove this guy didn't do it. What can I do to prove that? You do that, you're not going to really get a good answer. You got to follow where the evidence takes you and make logical conclusions based not on what you want it to say, but what it really seems to say.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's the human flaw, you know. When you get into the part where Violet Sharp, now she actually killed herself, didn't she? She drank silver or something or...
Yeah, she put silver polish into a glass with water and drank it died almost immediately.
That was a controversy in the fact of a lot of people thought she had guilt to hide, and that's why she killed herself. It wasn't about just because she was her lifestyle or anything like that.
Well, there were a lot of people that suggested that. The police suggested that because when she died, the press very much turned on the police on this thing. And you know, Lindbergh was not backing the police on that, and neither was the Morrow family. The Morrow family, for those who don't know, Lindbergh married the daughter of Ambassador Morrow. So his wife's family was very well known as well. And they all basically were defending Violet Sharp and saying she was hounded to her death, and the press went right along with it. So the police, a lot of times were saying, well, you know, there's possible guilt here. To give themselves some support. What I think really happened with Violet was this. Violet, first of all, had become physically sick, so she had lost a lot of weight there. She was getting hounded not only by the police but by the press as well because the story was getting out. I think what most likely happened, and I don't know definitively, nobody does, but I think based on the evidence, the most likely thing was she told a minor lie because she didn't want to admit that she went to a speakeasy. And she tried to say she went to a movie. She never figured they would follow up on it, but they did. and she couldn't name the movie, and there were problems. And eventually she admitted she went to a speakeasy called the Peanut Grill with somebody she hadn't met. She'd only met that day, and she agreed to go out with him. And then they started digging even deeper, and they found out she had previously dated a reporter for the Daily News. And that reporter, it looks like, may have used her to get information about the baby, not about the kidnapping, but when the baby was first born, it was nobody knew right away if it was a boy or a girl. They didn't announce it, and they were trying to get all kinds of information. And he was able to get information, you know, inside information from her about the baby, just, you know, casually discussing it. And so now they're accusing her of this, you know, did you talk to him again? And they were looking into all her past boyfriends that she had. And now, of course, there's the thought that she's going to lose, you know, not only her job, but lose her standing. And this began to eat on her. And she wrote a letter to her sister in England. And when you read the letter, you really see someone who is depressed, confused, and who really thinks her life is over. She wrote stuff like, life really is sad now, and things like that, and I don't know how I'm going to go on. And finally, they were going to question her again, and she just lost it. She never questioned me again. She ran up, and she poured the stuff into the glass, filled it with water, and drank it. And she was dead almost immediately. You know, my opinion is she's another victim of the case. Whether I'm right or not, you know, no one can be certain because it's not definitive why she did what she did. But I think, based on the evidence, I think my conclusion fits.
Yeah. Now the ladder itself, a lot of controversy. What was the, in your opinion, the strongest evidence supporting that the ladder was Hopman's?
One of the side rails, which has been called Rail 16, was, in my opinion, definitively proven to have come from a board that was part of the attic in Halpin's apartment. He lived on the second floor of a home, and the only access to the attic was from his apartment. And they definitively proved scientifically that that rail had once been part of a larger board that was part of his attic. And it was done based upon nail holes. It was done based upon the marks in the wood. They also were able to prove he had a carpenter's hand plane, and it had a nick in the blade, and they were able to show through tool identification testimony that this plane had been used on the ladder as well. This was evidence from a man named Kaler, who was from the United States Forestry Service, and his testimony was absolutely devastating. And his testimony has been reviewed by experts of today, and they have all confirmed his findings. And it's awful hard to argue that Halpin had nothing to do with this when the scientific evidence shows that one of the boards from the ladder came from his attic.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing was the money itself, how he was spending the ransom money and how he had a lot of it stored. He had said that Fish, I believe the name was, had left the money there.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, he had a friend named Isidore Fish, yeah.
Right. So first, I guess we have to go into, do you think Fish was involved?
No.
No.
No, I don't. Isidore Fish, his whereabouts are known on several of the important evenings that occurred, including the night of the kidnapping, and he wasn't anywhere near it. You know, the only person that's ever seen always fits the description of Bruner Halpin. There was nobody else seen in anything else. And plus, Isidore Fish had left and had gone back to Germany where he died of tuberculosis. He had no money with him. He was absolutely penniless. If he was involved, boy, he got the short end of the stick. He got no money, and he just went back home to Germany and died.
Yeah. And but do you think Hopman could carry this off by himself, the whole thing?
I think he could. You know, the question that is always still out there, and it cannot be definitively answered, is did Halpin have an accomplice? As I said, the physical evidence at the scene, particularly outside the home, was compromised because they didn't cordon it off. They found footprints that they thought went off in a direction towards Featherbed Lane, it was called. And they thought that's where the kidnapper went. I don't believe that is actually where the kidnapper went because the footprints were different than the original footprints that were seen. And I think it was more likely that was a reporter or a trooper. But there's no physical evidence that shows anybody other than one person entering the house. There were impressions from the and the inside of the house, from the window to the baby's bed. There were splotches of mud, but it was only one set. There wasn't a second set. So only one person went into the nursery. You know, there's no evidence. I mean, could somebody have been driving the getaway car? Sure, they could have. You know, there's nobody else was ever found with any of the money other than Halpin. There's only two pieces of physical evidence that I found that could be used to support the idea of an accomplice. One was a document found in Lindbergh's papers showing, if it is what it purports to be, and I have some questions, but it was there, showing that Halpin was looking to rent an apartment with a kitchen in Manhattan for 6 months, starting on March the 1st, 1932, which was the date of the kidnapping. The name on it, there were two names on it. They were obviously fake names, Mr. Lynch and Mr. Jones, obviously fake names.
Right.
But whether that means there was a second person or he just used the name, who knows? I also have some questions about that document because it doesn't exist in the archives in New Jersey. The New York City Municipal Archives had it in one of their folders, but their security wasn't quite the same as the New Jersey Archives, so it's possible somebody could have put that in there. I just don't know. But the second piece of evidence is after the ransom was paid, one of the things they made sure to do was include as much of the ransom as they could in what are called gold certificates. These looked like regular money, except they had a gold seal on them. People may have seen silver certificates every once in a while where it says, you know, the bearer is entitled to a certain amount of silver. Well, they had that, but for gold certificates. Well, in 1933, President Roosevelt took us off the gold standard, and he ordered that all of the gold certificates and gold coins had to be turned into different banks. And at the time they paid the ransom, the Treasury Department knew this was going to happen, so they made sure to include as much of those notes in the ransom money, because once they started getting turned in, it would become more noticeable, you know, when those would get passed around. Well, on the deadline, somebody walked into a national bank and they cashed in $2,980 worth of gold certificates. All of those bills were part of the ransom money, which is a significant amount. And the slip was signed J.J. Faulkner. And handwriting analysts have been unanimous that whoever wrote J.J. Faulkner on there and wrote that slip out was not Bruno Richard Halpin. The handwriting is not similar. And they've never been able to identify anybody related to the case that fits that handwriting. Now, whether that person, whoever it was, male or female, that brought that money in, whether or not they were an accomplice, perhaps after the fact helping Halpin launder the money, or early on, or if they're just somebody who somehow got a, you know, some hot money and then realized what it was, nobody knows. But it wasn't Halpin. So that is the closest thing I could find to physical evidence proving there was an accomplice. So the most I can say, and that's what I said in my book, is I think he probably did it alone, but it is possible he had help.
And how do you feel about his wife? Do you think that she was involved or she knew about it even after the fact?
I don't think she was involved before or after the fact. She always maintained her husband's innocence, but I found a few things that made me conclude that she suspected something was wrong, after the fact, not before. One of the things they did, and you can't do this today, but you could back then, when Anna Halpin would visit her husband, they spoke in their native language of German. So what the state police did is they had some troopers, including one named Hugo Stockberger, who spoke German. So they would arrange for German-speaking troopers to be there guarding him so that when he and his wife spoke, they would listen in and take notes about what they were talking about in German. You can't do that today, but back then you could. And one of the things that they were talking about, was they wanted Halpin to give some additional handwriting samples. And Anna made this curious comment. She said, when you give them your handwriting again, make sure you change the slant. Now, that could just be, you know what, they think your handwriting is similar, so change it. Or it could be she was starting to get suspicious. It's not definitive, but it was an odd statement.
Right.
But I've never found anything that would lead me to conclude that she was in on it. Now, in a book that came out just before mine, a book called Cemetery John, man who I've since met. He came to one of my book signings. I was so pleased by it. His name is Zorn, real nice guy. He wrote a theory that he thought Halpin was involved, but he wasn't the main guy. He put a suspect forward name. I believe his name was Noel, who he thought was the main guy. Nevertheless, in one of the footnotes, he makes a reference that one of the governors in New Jersey had interviewed the Attorney General, David Walensky, and that Walensky had said he had evidence that he could have indicted Anna Halpin. Whether that conversation took place, I don't know. That former governor and David Walensky are now deceased. But I've never found any evidence that would lead me to believe she could have been charged with anything.
I just have to wonder, but what he had in mind, and I mean that with Bruno, what did he have in mind? He didn't plan on killing the child. He didn't, like, that was clearly an accident falling down the ladder.
That's my belief, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he actually intended on kidnapping the child, like taking that child and getting the ransom. Mm-hmm. But where was he going to hold the child? Where was he going to put the baby? Do you think that apartment in New York or what? You know,
that's
if his
possible.
Wife didn't know, who would be taking care of mm-hmm. the baby? Because he has to live his life fairly normal. And if his wife didn't know, then he had to have some sort of plan.
You would think so. The apartment document is the only evidence I've found that leads to anything. One of the things that leads me to the conclusion that he didn't intend to kill the child is the way the child was buried. He didn't bring a shovel or anything. If he was planning to kill the child, you'd think he would have brought a proper shovel with him, but he didn't. Where he was planning to keep the child, nobody really knows. The only evidence I've ever found that gives any hint is that apartment receipt.
Yeah.
Short of that, I just don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, the police were speculating that he was having an affair with a woman named Gerda Henkel, but there's no evidence to show that Gerda Henkel knew anything about it.
Right.
So,
right.
And part of the problem is once the police focused on Bruno Richard Halpin, they stopped really looking for an accomplice. They became focused on making sure he got convicted.
Yeah, yeah. I just think that there was a missing element there because you're right. You know, he made a mistake. He didn't plan on killing the child, at least not on the ladder. He didn't. He didn't have it all planned, so it happened, but his intention must have been to hold the child somewhere, and if he wasn't going to do it, somebody else was, and if not his wife or the one he's having an affair with, you know what I mean?
They're just who?
Yeah, because
yeah.
Not only that.
No, there are holes in the case. There's no question. Anybody who ever comes out and says, I know everything there is to know about the Lippert case is either a fool or a liar, because it's not possible.
Yeah.
I mean, Mark Falzini, who is the head archivist at the New Jersey State Police Museum and Archives, is one of the most knowledgeable people I've ever dealt with when it comes to this case. I mean, he's forgotten more about this case than most people will ever know. And even he will say, I don't know everything about the case because nobody can.
Yeah, yeah, there's too many elements, and we weren't there. It was too long ago. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence. So now, and we talk about the execution. And so what was your opinion on you don't believe he should have been executed?
I don't. Two reasons. One, I personally don't support the death penalty, but putting that aside, because that really doesn't matter, it has to do with the way he was charged. In New Jersey in 1932, you could only be executed if you were convicted and charged properly with murder. Now, as you pointed out, there is no evidence that he intended to kill the child. In fact, the evidence supports that the child died accidentally. Well, an accidental death would be manslaughter. Well, the prosecution wanted to have this man executed. They wanted the death penalty. So they said, well, we'll use the felony murder doctrine. Now, for those who don't know, the felony murder doctrine basically states if you commit a felony and in the reasonable and foreseeable course of that felony somebody dies, then you can be found liable for murder. I mean, the classic example you see in law school. A person goes into a mom-and-pop store and holds up an elderly clerk using a water pistol that looks real. And the person gets scared, has a heart attack, and immediately dies. There's no question that person didn't intend to kill, because unless he's holding up the Wicked Witch of the West, a water pistol is not going to be fatal. However, it is reasonable that somebody seeing that is going to be scared. That's their intent. They want to think it's real, going to be scared. It's also reasonable if somebody older gets scared, they could have a heart attack, and if they have a heart attack, they could die. That person's guilty of felony murder. All right? But it has to be, what you do has to be a felony. And in most states, including New York, where I'm from, you hold up somebody with a pistol that you want them to believe is real, that's robbery too. That's a felony. So they said, well, we'll charge him with kidnapping, and then that's the felony. Well, the problem was, believe it or not, in New Jersey in 1932, kidnapping was a misdemeanor. It wasn't a felony.
Oh.
So if you charged him with kidnapping and say that the kid died in the course, reasonable course of that misdemeanor, well, that still makes him liable for the death, but it's manslaughter. You know, the misdemeanor murder, if you will, is manslaughter, and you can't execute for that. So they needed something else that they would go with. So somebody said, well, what about burglary? Burglary is a felony. And they said, well, burglary is defined at that time, knowingly entering or remaining in a dwelling at nighttime for the purpose of committing a felony therein. Well, what's the felony therein? It can't be kidnapping. Well, they said larceny. Well, no, you can't say larceny of a human being. That's kidnapping. So then they came up with the idea, well, wait a minute. He didn't just take the kid. He took the kid's night clothes. So they said, effectively, what they charged him with was felony murder that he knowingly and intentionally entered the Lindbergh dwelling at night for the purpose of stealing the Lindbergh baby's night clothes. And that in the reasonable course of that felony, the child died. So logically, taking it to its conclusion, if he had gone in during the day, or if they had put the child to bed naked, they couldn't have executed him. And although New Jersey Supreme Court affirmed that conviction on that theory, I disagree with it. The most I'll say, being an attorney and an officer of the court, albeit in another state, I can't be overly critical of judges, but I will say I respectfully disagree with their decision. And I feel that he should have been charged with manslaughter under the laws of Jersey. The laws today, it would be murder, but not the laws of New Jersey in 1932. And with the manslaughter conviction, the fact that they found a gun when they searched his home, that he had gold certificates that he wasn't supposed to have, they could have charged him with extortion in New York. He also immigrated to the United States twice illegally. They could have charged him with that. He could have gotten effectively a life sentence. And that's what I think should have happened. I just don't think, based on what they charged, that execution was appropriate there.
I think that's crazy, especially the kidnapping being a misdemeanor. I mean, that's...
Well, you know, kidnapping was... In those days, more often than not, when you saw a kidnapping in those days, it wasn't what you think of now. It was very often the child of somebody with wealth and prominence, and very often was done by the mob. And as long as you followed their instructions, the kidnapped person was normally returned. It was not that uncommon. The first case where you really see a kidnapping and a murder before Halpin was the Loeb Leopold case, which was, you know, basically was considered to be the first thrill killing. And then, of course, you had Halpin. But it was, you know, it wasn't like you saw later where, you know, you see kids disappear, don't talk to a stranger. Yeah. That only started after the Lindbergh case. You didn't really hear too much of that before that. I'm not saying it didn't exist, but you didn't hear about it that much. People didn't always lock their doors back then, and it was just a different time. And so there wasn't this need to make kidnapping a serious felony. That changed after the Lindbergh case.
You would just think there would be more of it then with, if it was just a misdemeanor, more people would try to do that with rich kids. You would think it would have become more common. That's all. But that's just a thought. Wow. This is pretty crazy case. So in at the very end of the day, do you think justice was served?
Well, with regards to the execution, no. With regards to him being convicted of the way they charged him, no. But do I think that Bruno Richard Halpin kidnapped the Lindbergh baby? Yes, I do. My belief, based on the research, is that Halpin did kidnap the child. I think more likely than not he did it alone, but I concede the possibility that there could have been somebody with him. I believe he was the one in the cemetery in the Bronx who extorted the money. And I think him being arrested and charged in that way would have been justice. The injustice, in my mind, is him being executed.
Whatever happened to his wife after he was executed? Do we know?
His wife lived for many years. She refused to, she was somewhat of a pioneer in that. You got all these people now who take a knee for the national anthem and won't recite the pledge. She refused to recite the Pledge of Allegiance because she felt her husband was wrongly treated. She moved. She lived in rural Pennsylvania with her son. And some years later, in the 1980s, she hooked up with an attorney from California who convinced her to bring a series of federal lawsuits against the state of New Jersey claiming wrongful death. They were all dismissed, but there was one positive of it. The governor at that time, Governor Florio, after getting these lawsuits, ordered the state police to gather up whatever evidence they still had and archive it and make it available for public review. So we did get the incredible New Jersey State Police Museum and Archives, you know, with all of their features on this case as a result of that. But she lived for quite a while, and she eventually passed of natural causes.
Quite a life, quite a story.
Wow. Well, I consider her a victim too. I mean, she was devoted to her husband. She was a hardworking housewife, and I don't think she really accepted or believed that her husband did it. She might have had some suspicions, it's not clear, but she was devoted to him. She never remarried, and she was devoted to him and would tell anybody that would listen that she didn't think her Richard had done it.
Yeah. Well, you know, and in her mind, it's, you know, I guess that's what she believed. Wouldn't you think that she would have seen him taking the wood and creating the ladder and... I don't know.
Not necessarily. I mean, he had a separate garage where he would work. And, you know, it's a different time. I mean, in those days, a wife did not question if her husband was outside. Didn't question on it. That wasn't done then.
Right.
You know, this idea today, you know, men and women were equal, which is the right thing. That wasn't so prevalent back then. And, you know, he would not have discussed certain things with her. It just wasn't the way it was done. And, you know, if he was working out in the garage and building something, that wouldn't necessarily be unusual. He was a carpenter. So for him to build something or be working in the garage would not be that unusual. And for him to have a ladder, if she'd seen it, wouldn't have been unusual because, he was a carpenter. He would go to job sites. So, of course, carpenters might be on ladders working. It wouldn't be unusual.
Yeah, yeah. It was a way different time. I mean, we're talking the 30s. I can remember my father back at talking with my oldest brother and his wife, and she started talking about selling a house and finances, and my father got really upset. You know, a woman should never talk about
his error. It wasn't done.
Yeah. So
yeah. In his error, it wasn't done. You know, today it's outrageous, but back then that was the norm.
Yeah, and so I could imagine. There was just a different set of rules. Crazy. Well. Again, this has been great. I really enjoyed it, and I think people should pick up the book. I recommend it. It's on our website. Of course, it's on Amazon, and where all good books are sold. And thank you for being on the show.
And they actually recently came out with an audio version.
Though
they make one mistake that drives me crazy. Yeah. They keep saying Kohler. His name was Kaler. Drives me crazy.
Yeah,
but they just did that on their own, but... It's still, other than that, it's very good.
I listened to it. It was great. I do a lot of listening, and I thought it was great.
Yeah, Jim Sykes was the narrator. He was very good.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of good ones out there, and I think it's the wave of the future for books. So it's a good thing.
No doubt.
It's Richard T. Cahill, Jr. Don't punch in the other ones. Make sure you put the Jr. in there. And otherwise, you'll get a different type of book. So
this is true.
Well, thank you for taking the time when you got a cold.
I appreciate it very much.
Pardon me. Do you have any Grey Poupon?
Holy fruit salad.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
Hello, this is Stephen's True Crime Commentary, and as usual, I am Stephen David Lampley. Welcome back. Listen, I'm going to do something a little different today. I'm going to spend this commentary with the topic of what is it really like being a police officer. There's lots of television shows that try to show or tell, but they fall so short. What I'm about to tell you, you may not hear from the news media. What I'm about to tell you, most police officers won't tell you. I'm about to. So, what's it really like being a police officer? It's one in the afternoon and you begin to get ready for work. It's the same thing most people do before they go to work. You put on your bulletproof vest. As you're putting the vest on, you think of your wife, your kids, and the thought in the back of your mind is, you just may not come home tonight, today. That's the harsh reality of it all. As you secure the bulletproof vest straps, you think quietly to yourself, yes, you may not come home. It's always a possibility. You leave the bedroom and make your way to the den where your spouse and kids are. You give your spouse and kids a kiss and a hug, and it's a different hug than a kiss and a hug than you give when you're going to the store. This hug and kiss could be the last one you will ever be able to give them. Getting in your car, you back out of the driveway and look up at your home. Little hands are waving and blowing you kisses. Your spouse does the same, but you can see the look of concern in her eyes. Even though she tries to hide it, it's still there. You wait back and put the car in drive and begin your trip to the precinct to begin your shift. Your mindset changes as you prepare for the shift ahead. You pass the tree on your way to work. The tree that in the academy they told you to find something on your way to work and on your way home, where on your way home you could drop off everything that happened on your shift and leave it there. So when you go home, you're the husband or the wife that you're supposed to be, and you're not worrying about work and you're not talking about work. You leave everything there. You leave it there. So as you head back to work, you pass the tree and you pick up everything that you left there before. The murders, the homicides, the investigations you're working on, all the things you've seen and heard, you pick back up and take back to work with you. You arrive at the precinct. It's time for roll call. You sit as you listen to the sergeant tell you things that you didn't do that you should have, or things that you did do that you shouldn't have. You'll hear crimes of importance and administrative announcements, and all through it all, you'll hear off-color humor from other officers, maybe even yourself. It's common as a sergeant reads the announcements, with laughter among the officers and sometimes even from the sergeant. Roll call is over, and if you have time, you stand and make small talk with the other officers prior to getting in your car and starting your shift. In your car, you head to your beat. The first pass, you're looking to see how things are now so that if you pass by later and something's different, you'll know something's out of place and may warrant being checked on. You ride and you ride and you ride. 8, 10, maybe 12-hour shifts. You'll receive calls on anything and everything you can imagine. Robberies in progress, burglaries, assaults. An elderly lady who has a bat in her bedroom. Loud music complaints. Rapes. Shoplifters. Land disputes. You'll get a call from someone who didn't get the right order at the drive-thru at a restaurant. You'll answer domestic disputes. Murders. Vehicle collisions. Calls on counterfeit money. Worthless checks and forgeries. Dog barking. Neighborhood speeders. Flat tires. And the list goes on and on and on. So now you end your shift, relatively uneventful, thankfully. You turn in your paperwork and you head home. You pass that tree going home and you leave what happened during your shift. Hit that tree as always. So what's it really like being a police officer? Being a police officer is knowing that you'll probably never ever vacation in Europe. It's knowing that it's very likely you may need some type of government assistance even to get by. Especially if you have children. The pay is totally inadequate most times. Being a police officer is knowing that you're constantly exposed to hepatitis and HIV and that it's not always possible to protect yourself before the shit hits the fan. It's knowing that police officers have the highest rate of divorce than any other employment group. being a police officer is knowing that the friends you had before you became a police officer are probably going to alienate themselves from you. You may find that your new friends are other police officers, friends who understand what it is to be a police officer. Being a police officer is knowing that stress is going to eat away at you. Any police officer knows that she is constantly looking around and over her shoulder every minute of the shift. You see, some people like to kill police officers for no other reason than they're police officers. It's knowing that you cannot eat in just any restaurant. The officers who have been at the precinct longer than you know the police-friendly restaurants, the ones who will prepare your food without spitting in it or wiping it on their butts. It does happen. Being a police officer is knowing that even though a spouse in a domestic assault calls you asking for help, he or she may very well turn on you when you start to put the other spouse in jail. Being a police officer is having that deep down dread as you're given a call from the dispatcher to deliver a death message to the parents of a teenager. You see, now you have to wake them up at 3:12 in the morning, and you have to be the one to tell them that their 16-year-old daughter's dead. It's knowing that you'll miss a lot of family events like birthdays and Christmas, Thanksgiving, and vacations. It's trying to decide how best to handle a juvenile who has gotten in trouble. Do you try to work with the situation and help them and release them to their parents, or take them to juvenile? Being a police officer is holding a dying baby in your arms and knowing there's nothing you can do to help. Nothing you can do but cry. Being a police officer is watching another human being burned alive in a house and you cannot get to him. There's nothing you can do. Being a police officer, it's knowing that your career can have a horrible effect on your health and shorten your lifespan. Police are at greater risk of brain cancer, 800% more likely to commit suicide. Police officers are more likely to be depressed. They're more prone to accidental injuries, sleep disorders, weight gain, heart disease. They're more prone to congestive heart failure, and the list goes on. That's a short list of what being a police officer is. That's by no means inclusive. But you see, men and women across the world are willing to go out on a limb knowing this and still help in any way they can with the risks that they face every day. And knowing the possible outcome to their families, and knowing the possible outcome to their health. But being a police officer can be an extremely rewarding career. There are times that you can help people that indeed are genuinely happy and thankful that you were there. You can save lives. You can make a difference in people's lives, a positive influence, a positive difference. Men and women across the world know the risks, but yet they still act. Men and women across the world know the risks, and yet they still put on that uniform and come and save you and me. That is all.
Thank you for tuning into Stephen's True Crime Commentary, heard across America. You are invited to visit Stephen's website for information on his books, speaking dates, and speaking programs like How to Catch a Liar. In this seminar, Stephen explains some of the very same techniques police detectives use to help them determine if someone is lying. You will learn such things as global versus individual indicators, use of contractions, voice tone, eye shift, evasion, allusion, pronoun usage, question pause, base shift, and much more. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for information on this seminar and much more.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.